My name is Caleb Dunover. I'm 18 years old. Today is November 25th, 2018, and I'm speaking with Aisha Dunover, who is my aunt. We are recording this interview in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Can you tell me about one or two people who have been the biggest influences on your life?
Yeah, okay. Auntie Dolores, because she didn't teach me how to read, but she gave me a love for reading. She used to read everything. I mean, if you leave her in a car, she'd read a car manual. Who else? Maybe your dad. I wound up a lot of places because he told me to. I went to college because he said he had gone there and it was pretty and he thought it seemed like me. I went to Chicago because it seemed like us. I went to New Orleans because he told me to. I'm still there. I don't know why, but yeah, probably a lot of those where I wound up decisions. I went to Hampton. I went to Hampton because he told me to go to HBCU. And then he told me to go to that one. And I went there. And so a lot of relationships that I've made in life, a lot of the choices that I've made, a lot of the places that I've been and gone. Yeah, probably started with him saying, "You should do that," and me saying, "Okay."
So what is like one thing that y'all two like share in common, like
a sense of humor? I am probably the only person who thinks this, but I think he's the funniest person I've ever met. And I think people who remind me of him are people who are funny. He is corny. And I like corny. I think it's hilarious. We walked into a place that was absolutely awful in Dallas. He was moving, and we walked into this place. It was an apartment. They showed it to us. It was far from ready. It was absolutely awful. And we both walk in, and you knew we'd been raised in the same house because we both walked in. And said at the same time, "Oh, there's a fireplace," because it was the only nice thing to say. And the lady left us, and when you came back, you found us up in the corner just shaking because we were laughing so hard. But he's the funniest person I know.
Is there like one moment that y'all both shared that was like probably like a good moment that y'all really enjoyed together?
Probably when he graduated from college, I was really, really proud of him. Yeah.
Did you think that, like, were you in college at this point probably too?
I was.
So, yeah. Did that, like, encourage you to, like, to keep on going to do more? Is that already, like, set you aside that I want to do that kind of thing? I want to graduate too, kind of, basically.
No, I was so, like, not just a little sister, but I felt like, I don't know, like I really had to be his cheerleader. And I don't know, it's just, it didn't encourage me to do it because I was already doing it, but I don't know, I was just really proud of him. It's for a long time, it was just us, so.
So on the book thing, so like what book kind of like set you off to like,
oh, my favorite book when I was little was And to Think You Saw It on Mulberry Street. It turns out I didn't know this at the time, but it's Dr. Seuss's first book that he ever wrote. And it's the little boy, I want to say Marvin, but he, every day he goes home and his father asks him about what he's seen in the world. And he never sees anything interesting. So this day, all he sees is a horse drawn by a cart as he goes down Mulberry Street. So he decides this day he's really going to show his father something. So he's like, maybe I don't say it's a horse. Maybe I see it's a zebra and blah, blah. And it just grows and grows and grows to it's like this massive parade with a circus built in going down. He gets all the way home, races through the door, and then, of course, decides he can't lie to his father. He has to tell him what he really saw. And that was my one book. Not my one book, but that was like the one book that I had at our dad's house. And I read it every single solitary weekend. And I love to this... I think my shirt's inside out. To this day, I love Dr. Seuss. It is, my shirt's on inside out. To this day, I love Dr. Seuss. My favorite. And we would just... I don't know, we would devour books. We had some book subscriptions when we were kids. And they had... was it now? Scholastic Reading, where you, it was like, I don't know, market day for books, and you got to order, and, but that would have been, but now since then, book that I could probably read over and over, my first favorite book was, not my first, but like grown-up book was the autobiography of Malcolm X. That was, I wanted to leave a class because of that book, because at the end my English teacher thought it was really appropriate to tell us that to like pull out like things from FBI files that they had gathered on Malcolm X and wanting to dispute things that he had said in his autobiography. And I just thought that was a booty butt move. Like, I don't know, I just felt like he felt he needed to make sure that he crushed it for us. 100 Years of Solitude, wonderful book. It's a little confusing at the beginning because like half the characters have the same name, but wonderful book. Those are some.
So you have a degree in like history, I believe, right?
Yes.
So what did a book kind of inspire you to do history kind of thing? Or just like seeing different things? Because like you said, Mulberry Street, I'm guessing that inspired you because you kind of like traveling places. So.
My second favorite teacher was Mrs. Schroeder. She was my sixth grade social studies teacher. And she really kind of put me on the path that history was what I enjoyed the most. Because I think that was the first one where like social studies was a real class, a separate class. Ooh, you are wonderful. Where social studies is the most, was the most interesting class. And after that, I think I took two social studies classes with her in junior high. And it just became kind of what I liked. And I did AP European History in high school. And I don't know if you remember, Natalie, Mr. Beveridge, for some strange reason, he wasn't, but he thought he was British. So he had this like fake British accent that he used the whole time. And he took us through, I can't remember the name of the author, but it was like the collected, it was like the European world history book. But for whatever reason, in this world history book, up until really World War II, it's European history. And then Actually, I got to college and I didn't have to take any history classes because I had phased out and I wasn't a history major at the time. And I went to Europe and the only classes that they taught were art and history. Art, history, and architecture. And so I did the history classes there. I had a wonderful history teacher, this guy, Keith Knut, at the University of Wisconsin. And just sparked a love. And when it got time, I changed my major and I thought, do I want to get out with the degree that's useful? And this is a bad decision, by the way. Or do I want to get out with the degree that I love? And I thought at this point, it's important just to get out. So I'm going to do what I love. And I got a history degree. And with that, I'm able to flip burgers and shake fries, I guess. I'm very, very equipped to be a good contestant on Jeopardy. And that's what I'm, that is what I'm capable of. So when Jeopardy comes off, I'm your girl. But that's pretty much what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be on Jeopardy. But then I went further and studied international studies so that I could be, you know, really good at Jeopardy.
So what kind of inspired you to do Jeopardy? What inspired you about Jeopardy? Like, is it like one of your favorite shows?
It is. I love Alex Trebek. I think he is the coolest, cruelest man ever. I just think he's cocky in a way that I like. But I like knowing things. I like, I always like to study and like to read, so history was kind of a good fit because it's just a lot of learning and researching and figuring out what happened when. The more you get into it, the more you want to learn. Because I remember in school we learned a lot of truncated history, a lot of things where you learned a little bit of a story. And once you actually learn the full bit, it makes far more sense. It keeps us from repeating things. It keeps us from being insular because you learn about the rest of the world. The one regret I would say for the U.S. education system is you don't learn as much about the rest of the world as you could. We don't learn anything about South America. We only learn about things that we influence there. So like they'll tell you about the Panama Canal, but only because as it relates to us. You don't really learn a lot about Asia. You don't learn very much about Africa, past colonization. Although, I have to say, when I was in sixth grade and we did world history, it was the worst possible time to take it because all the countries changed the next year. So, like, I learned Czechoslovakia. Rhodesia was still a country then. Zaire was still a country. Yugoslavia. So, all those places, you're like, oh, they no longer exist right after I learned them. That was before the Berlin Wall came down, everything. Because you learn that, I think, seventh grade, and then all that happened, like, eighth grade. What else? But, yeah, they don't teach you a lot about the world outside of that kind of European or Western centric thing. I remember getting to Austria and this lady asked me, she said, why don't Americans know anything about Austria? And I said, because in our history books you cease to exist after 1938. You don't pop up in the book anymore. So as far as what you've done lately, you know, being annexed by Hitler was kind of your last greatest hit. But it's not true. A lot happened after that, but we don't really learn anything about it. Spain stops being a country of importance after the after World War, after the wars, our history books kind of shift to more of U.S. history than really a more global history. And then I don't know what year it stopped for you, but in my classes, it stopped about the 70s. So anything that happened after that, we really didn't cover. And that's if your school, if the class was good enough to keep going and make it to the end of the book.
Yeah, for me, my history book stops in the early 2000s. And because when I was learning United States history, it stopped really around the time when Obama was elected, because I was in sixth grade, and that was around his second term-ish.
Yeah.
And so that's why it stopped around there. And then just in 11th grade, we just started talking about what's it called, the end of Obama's second term, and talking about that stuff. And mostly didn't talk much about Obama. We just talked because my history teacher mostly talked about like what Obama did. And then, but mostly the stopping point for us was really George W. Bush, because really that's a major point in history, because most of like the Afghanistan wars and all the stuff happened during that time.
Okay.
And really, Obama really was just showing just how he kind of handled that stuff when it switched over from George Bush to him.
Okay.
And that's really what I stopped. So did you like, was there like any, since you were part of any moment of history, like during the 80s and 90s, was there anyone that really like stuck out to you when you were living in that moment, really?
This sounds sad, but it's sad that this was a moment in history, but it really did change kind of, I think it definitely changed television, it changed how we talk to each other, but for it to be such a silly event, OJ, senior year, I was on my way to prom, and I watched the Bronco chase in the limo. And it was the stupidest thing ever. One, he's going like 2 miles an hour down an expressway, and no one caught this dude till he took himself back home and turned himself in. But I don't know. I remember 2 years later, like we were trying to get out of class to watch The Verdict, and it really was something that like captivated a nation for a couple of years. It changed how we viewed TV. It became really salacious, and everybody's looking for the gotcha moment, and all the where the cameras follow you overhead, and I don't know. I think that was the beginning of the end, OJ.
So, like, when you went to Austria, like, what kind of made you want to go there? Like, was there anything that made you want
to
go?
I had been before. So I'd gone to Vienna, and we stayed at like a camping ground and had a good time. And then we went to Innsbruck, and that was like our vacation spot. So I signed up to take German history class, and the professor retired, and he was my advisor. And so he had said, oh, there's another great professor in our department. And he teaches Austrian history. And although no Austrian would ever want to hear you say this, I thought, same thing. Okay, close enough. So I'll take Austrian history instead. My teacher was absolutely awesome. Took every course that he taught. But our class was really small. So instead of having it in the classroom where we were supposed to, he held it in the University of New Orleans had a Center for Austrian Studies. And he held the classroom in the conference room of that center. And they had this thing up about going to the Diplomatic Academy in Vienna, but you had to speak two of three languages, so English was my one. But you had to also either be relatively fluent, at least enough to conduct courses in or participate in courses in German or French. And so I thought, oh, I'm gonna, you know, start looking to do this. And there was one day we were leaving, and there was a lady there. She was the resident director in Innsbruck, and she just stopped us as we were leaving class and was like, hey, you all are taking Austrian history. Do any of you want to go to Innsbruck? I was like, I've been to Innsbruck before. I had a great time. I'd like to go. And so started talking to her about the Diplomatic Academy. And she was like, yeah, we can, you know, you can practice your German, or non-existent though it was at the time, and prepare yourself to go to this school. So I wound up going. That's another great guy, another great teacher for questions back. Dr. Bischoff did a lot of historical fiction, so which for me kind of was the best of both worlds. And he did these great books. One was the Radetzky March, and it was about an Austrian family, and you were able to trace kind of the waning days of the empire through this family. The family had, one of the family members, I don't know if it's grandpa or great grandfather, but I think it was grandfather, had gained favor with, Franz Joseph, the last, Austrian-Hungarian emperor. I think he, like, I don't know, I can't remember what it was, where he saved him falling off a horse or something, and then following the grandfather to so the grandfather had gotten for the family some elevated office in Galicia, which is where the family was from, and some rank, and passed it on to the son, and or to the, yeah, to the father. So that was the grandfather to the father, and then the son, and the son's kind of you could see the empire falling apart in the life of the son, and he eventually, when the war kicks off, he becomes a deserter and flees. We had a similar book for Sacred Willow, which tracked the family through the different changes in Vietnam, or at the time that it started out, French Indochina. A lot of those that were really, really, really good that stayed with me.
So it's like with history. So do you like, so why does the history more intrigue you more, even more, it's like still today?
I don't, it's one, it's important to know what happened so you don't do it again. It's important to learn from not just your successes but your failures. Had we learned from the French, we probably would have not gone into Vietnam. Or had we listened to the French lessons they were trying to tell us. So I think those things are important. Plus, I like a good story. I am nosy. I'm extremely nosy. And so it's like, I don't, it's like a little bit of, it's a very sanitized version of gossip, you know, like you want to know what happened. And Dr. Beveridge, who was the AP, history teacher in Edwin E. Young, he told it very much that way. Like it was like, oh. And let me tell you what happened next. Oh, and then they said this, and then they did this. He very much told it as a way of like the kind of the gossip rag of the day, but he was really giving us the history of whatever, whoever the reigning house was, whatever we were discussing. And so for me, it's all those little background details. The more minute, the more human it becomes, the more interesting it is. I keep trying to get my friends to read this book, it's a team of rivals. So that was the Lincoln biography. It was the book that loosely that they based the Lincoln book on. And it was amazingly well written. 700 something pages. When Lincoln died, I cried like a baby, like I didn't see it coming. I mean, I had to get myself together. But there was so much in it, so much about his thought process, how he developed this team, how, you know, each individual's worldview when they came together, how that changed or magnified his thought process, where they started off from competitors to really moving together as a team to kind of improve the country. Where were some of those near misses, those little moments that would have changed history?
So what, like, so I asked you about, like, what was your favorite moment in history while you were still around. So I was like, what past moment in history like stood out to you, like before you were even born?
I don't know before I was born, but I know there was a moment that happened before I got there. We, so I guess 2003, we went to Sarajevo, and looking at that city, first we met the presidents, because even though it was years after the conflict, one of the ways that they had decided or to be able to exist and to end the conflict, they had three separate presidents, and so it was kind of rotating who would be the chief president. It was interesting kind of seeing they were making it work, but a level of dysfunction as the only resolution to a conflict. Going through, you walk through the town, a lot of the buildings are still riddled with bullets. You look out in the, because you're kind of down in the valley, you look up around and every green space has been turned into a cemetery. So you really get to feel the amount of loss that this country did. When you're outside of the old city, they tell you don't walk off the grass because folks had mined their properties as a way to preserve ownership so that when they came back, there wasn't some new family living there, which is obscene to me that house meant enough to you that you would sacrifice somebody's life for it. Because surely someone lost a map and injured themselves terribly trying to get back home. But the other thing, too, is you can see every bit of history in that town. You can see everyone who came through. Every conquering hero is stamped on the architecture. There's still the call of prayer in the morning from the mosque. There's still a lot of kind of old world Austrian influences there. It just really, a lot of things were, it's one of those places where you could see history. You can see the changes that it made, or the things that were left after one group moved out and another group moved in. That was one of the few places where I'm like, if no one told me, I could tell you exactly who's come through here. Because it was stamped on everything. So that was a place where you really felt the history of it.
So since you live in New Orleans, what is there any like moments in history that you thought like, oh, that's a great moment in history that happened maybe in New Orleans? Something.
Ooh. Sadly, I took no classes in Louisiana history. Just and interested. But you can you can tell kind of how settlements happened there through the architecture from the original French Quarter and how the city branches out to where the Germans lived, out in Des Almonds, to the Spanish sections of town. You can kind of see, I guess that's more, I don't know why they never studied architecture, but where you could really start to see who came through, where they lived, how they lived in the city, through how the city's designed. Occupied his house on Valmont. The back house, that back section that became a carport, was a slave quarters. She had this little teeny tiny bathroom. That's where the help used to be able to go to the bathroom. Out off of the kitchen by the back door. Just in the way folks still interact with each other, you could tell that was one of the last places where people were made free. You could feel that there. You could feel that difference.
So was there like any certain part of New Orleans that you really like about it?
Uptown, I like the architecture. I like those big, grand, old houses. They're ones where you won't find them anywhere else. You can see those uptown. You can see it right on the edges of the river in like old Algiers when you cross there. Like along Esplanade where you can see these big houses and the carriage houses in the back as you go down to City Park and along the bayou. So a lot of places that like exist right along the water are great.
So, comparing New Orleans and Chicago, which city had a more major influence on you,
probably? Chicago for sure. Absolutely. Because it's where, you know, I spent my developmental years. There was I was in New Orleans for a while before I felt like I lived there. And by that I mean like where I felt like I lived with New Orleanians. Like I'd worked, but I really interacted with like university students who were from all over, or with my family who, even if they were from there, they were kind of the separate, they still existed in my own bubble. And then after Katrina, I lived and worked in a center for seniors. And so that didn't still feel the same because they were all generations older than I was. But after Katrina, I worked at a place where if it was maybe 100, 120 of us, probably at least 90 people in that group were in my age group, like between 30 and 35, with about 90 of the employees. And for the first time, I was working with folks who were kind of my peers, and I discovered how much I didn't know about New Orleans culture just working in those few years of working with them. They would say stuff, and I was like, "Do you really say that?" Like I heard it, but I always thought it was a joke. I didn't realize people were saying that for real, or phrases that I'd never heard before. I remember, somebody saying, "Oh, I got my daughter's nanny," and I was like, "Oh, wow, you pay for a nanny?" And they were like, no, that's what they call a godmother." And I'd never heard that before, and by that point, I'd been living there for a number of years. So there's still a lot of stuff in New Orleans that I don't know or comprehend. But Chicago, no. Chicago would definitely be what formed me. Probably less Chicago and more the Chicago suburbs, really.
So where do you see the differences and the similarities between the Chicago suburbs and the inner city type stuff?
One is space. Things are a little further apart. There were things that just basic little small things, like we all took the local school bus, the yellow school bus, and when you got to the city, unless, because most schools were local, that's starting to change a little bit, but most schools were your local school, so they were in walking distance, so kids didn't take bus, and when you got older, your schools, you took the city public transportation and not buses, so you were far more sheltered and kept in kind of a kids-only environment in the suburbs, where you were more in, like, you know, like an 8-year-old or an 8th grader getting on a bus and taking themselves, you know, 60 or 70 blocks to school would have been unheard of and thought kind of to be unsafe in the suburbs, whereas in the city it just was. I remember I'd never seen, and not to say that people in suburbs don't fight, they did. It was just something that I'd never seen. And we saw our first day of school. I couldn't get to my locker because it was two girls and a boy were fighting. And I'd not seen that before. Not that I hadn't seen a fight. I hadn't seen a fight with this girl. And she was giving it to this dude. We're fighting like that. My mother used to say, young ladies don't curse. It was just very unladylike. And I remember standing there, and these girls were going down the street, and they were coming up behind me, and they were cussing to beat the band. I mean, just filthy. And I was thinking to myself, oh my goodness, young ladies don't talk like that. I hadn't come to that realization that that was something my mother said. I thought young ladies don't talk like that, and I was floored that they spoke that way, and that nobody was saying anything. I was just like, oh my goodness. I was not allowed to go to our local school, like our local Chicago school. So we went to it young because it wasn't a reality that I could have dealt with. Coming from the suburbs, it would have been, coming from the suburbs, Whitney Young was a massive transition for me. And coming from Whitney Young to our local high school, which brought us the wonder that is R. Kelly, would have been a, like, I wouldn't have made it out of there. I wouldn't have, it would have been too much for me.
Well, thank you for telling me these things. I learned a lot, and it kind of showed me, like, the similarities of, like, between me and you, how we both have a love for history and a love for reading. And it showed me, like, we kind of had similar experiences. Like, I had teachers that really inspired me, that drove me to, like, do a lot of stuff with history and how my passion with history. But how, even though history is one of my passions, it wasn't like a good part of my life, because even though I did major things, like I did the history beat, national history beat, and stuff like that, and I did stuff like, I did a lot of historical stuff when I was younger, but then that's what kind of pushed me to my interest in engineering, because history showed me that you shouldn't repeat yourself and how you should strive for the better, and how I wanted to do things where I would make things on my own or help be part of a team that could help create something so those things couldn't repeat itself, really. And I guess that kind of was what history kind of was to me. And it kind of showed me that the past was great, but also it shows that how today some of those same things are happening over and over again, the bad parts of history. There was some good parts of it, but the bad parts seem to come because some people don't look at the past like some people do. And they should just repeat it, because they didn't learn themselves about what the past was, really. And
one good thing about history too, it's something that you can do on the side. Sounds bad, but like, nobody's gonna be an amateur engineer or an amateur chemist, but you could be an amateur historian and really enjoy that passion. Yeah. Do something else. I mean, you're not going to be, you know, in journals or what have you, but but I still think you can still get those life lessons and what matters from history, I think. But, yeah, I don't want to downplay history. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed my time as a history major, and I wouldn't change it. I probably would just complement it with some other things, but it really was where my passion lied, and I probably, if I had stuck with economics, wouldn't be using it either.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.